KPFT FM HD2, Houston.
Mike Koenig on 90.1 KPFT HD2, where we discuss local, state, national, and international stories. My co-host, Andrew Ferguson, is off tonight. Our first story from CommunityImpact.com, riders will soon have access to free Wi-Fi system-wide on Metro vehicles. Metro's addition of the free Wi-Fi on its buses, paratransit vehicles, and trains will occur over the next several months in a phased rollout, it said in the release. According to Metro Public Information Officer Monica Russo, over 50% of Metro's vehicles are already equipped with free Wi-Fi. So that's going to be great for riders of Metro. Our next story, Harris County establishes Flood Resilience Trust. This is also from CommunityImpact.com. Harris County Commissioners Court established an $833 million Flood Resilience Trust at its June 29th meeting as a means of filling the funding gap the Harris County Flood Control District is currently facing with regard to its $2.5 billion bond program approved by voters in 2018. As previously reported by Community Impact newspaper, the 2018 bond program was created and presented to voters as being composed of $2.5 billion in flood control district bonds, plus an additional $2.5 billion from planned federal, state, and local partners. However, the Harris County Budget Office presented data March 9th revealing a $1.3 billion shortfall in funds, needed to complete all the flood mitigation projects included in the 2018 bond program, due largely in part to a lack of partner funds. Bond returned to the court at the June 29 meeting. The Flood Control District outlined an updated funding plan for the 2018 bond program. Similarly, the budget department recommended a number of actions. Upon implementation, county officials said the key recommendations are expected to fully fund and ensure equitable progress across the 2018 bond program, while also laying the groundwork for the district's needs beyond the 2018 bond program. The court unanimously approved both updated funding plans. Precinct 1 Commissioner Rodney Ellis said, "With this Flood Resilience Trust, we're taking money that we could have used on other projects, flood mitigation projects or transportation projects. But the GLO, the Texas General Land Office, put the screws to us with money that was not theirs. It was federal money. So we have to create this trust to make up the funding if we don't get it from the GLO. We're robbing Peter to pay Paul because we have not gotten the money from the GLO." So I hate to be cynical, but I wonder if the problem with the Texas GLO releasing federal funding is related to the fact that Harris County is heavily Democratic. And as we discussed last week, Republicans in Austin tend to do what Republicans in Texas want, not necessarily what is best for Texans. From CommunityImpact.com, this is a good snapshot of the hiring problems facing the hospitality industry generally. It's entitled, "Cyfair Restaurant Owners Struggle to Fill Job Openings." Now hiring signs are posted outside restaurants across Cyfair, from locally owned eateries to fast food chains. Employers are incentivizing applicants actively searching for jobs. Local restaurant owners said they're shocked people are not taking advantage of the surplus of job openings, some requiring no experience, as they recover from a global pandemic. The Gulf Coast Workforce Board, the public workforce system in the 13-county Houston Galveston region, found that food preparation, operation, and servers had the second highest job demand among all industries in February. About 20,573 food industry jobs in the region, including servers, food preparation workers, and various positions in fast food chains, were open at the time. The restaurant industry is struggling to stay afloat and cater to the high volume of customers coming in as COVID-19 vaccine availability is more widespread, local business owners said. Even with a $250 signing bonus incentive for employees to stay longer than 90 days, Mia's table manager, Alicia Valdivia, said she cannot find enough workers to open the new Cypress location on Fry Road. Valdivia said she believes Mia's table is not drawing in workers because they are unmotivated to return to work, especially if they've been receiving unemployment benefits. Governor Greg Abbott announced to the U.S. Department of Labor on May 17th that Texas would be opting out of federal unemployment compensation related to the COVID-19 pandemic effective June 26th, which includes the expiration of a $300 weekly supplemental benefit. In terms of returning to work, a survey of 506 Americans who became unemployed during the pandemic was conducted by the U.S. Chamber of Commerce in late May regarding barriers to reentering the workforce. 49% of respondents said they're not actively looking for work. 30% said they do not expect to return to work this year. 13% said they never plan to return to work. So some of them are just retired or whatever. 23% of respondents said they lack the skills or experience necessary for most jobs available. 24% of respondents reported childcare and family needs preventing them from returning to work. And 26%, which is a lot, reported COVID-19 concerns as reasons they are not looking for work. Another issue facing a return to the workforce for some unemployed workers is salaries, not meeting the needs of workers to afford basic things such as childcare or health insurance. In Harris County, the average family of four needs to bring in $6,084 monthly to afford housing, food, transportation, health care, and other necessities, according to the Economic Policy Institute, a nonprofit, nonpartisan think tank that considers the needs of low and middle-income workers in economic policy discussions. Wages are really a benefit to society as a whole, so seeing workers be able to kind of negotiate wages is really a good thing for everybody, they said. To cover more tables with a smaller staff, Marty Wadsworth, vice president of marketing at Willie's Grill and Ice House, said the restaurant switched over to a digital ordering system combined with servers bringing out food to the tables for faster turnover rates. Our team members during the last 6 months here are averaging over $20 an hour right now, he says, simply by picking up more tables. If you go to the article, I can't post it really on my blog, but there is actually a chart showing minimum wages for California, Florida, Georgia, Illinois, Michigan, New York, North Carolina, Ohio, Pennsylvania, and Texas. Georgia, Florida, Michigan, North Carolina, Pennsylvania, and Texas have the lowest hourly wages. And I would be surprised if a great many waiters made $20 an hour a lot of the time. It's going to be variable by day, by hour, by shift. Melissa Stewart, executive director of the Texas Restaurant Association, said hiring bonuses and referral bonuses are common when trying to recruit more staff members at restaurants. While some are eager to return to the workforce, the challenges of finding good child care for single parents is still weighing on families, Stewart said. Employment may resume at a normal rate when schools and daycares open up in the fall to give those parents a chance to work. In the meantime, Stewart said she encourages restaurateurs to highlight the benefits of working in the industry, such as flexible hours, competitive pay, a great starting job for high school or college students, and a reliable second job when needed. They're great for somebody who needs that extra little income, she said. As I said earlier, I think $20 an hour is a really optimistic number for most servers and hospitality workers. It equals $41,600 a year before taxes. Now let's take a look at the next story, which has sort of an oblique bearing on this. From CommunityImpact.com, home construction accelerates in Cyfair's remaining open land tract. As SciFair's remaining large tracts of land are built out, PASA, the Population and Survey Analyst, projects by 2024 the development of multifamily units will outpace the growth of single-family homes, amounting to about 18,220 new units by 2030. I'll paraphrase an old saying here that people don't need a place to live in the long term. They need a place to live. So there's that. Fred Caldwell, president and CEO of Caldwell Companies, a developer, said that math probably is accurate only in that we're running out of land in SciFair. PASA estimates about 13% of SciFair's developable land is yet to be developed, most of which is east of the Grand Parkway and south of Highway 290. When you look at a map, it's pretty far out there. Just ballparking here. They're talking in the article about the price of homes, single-family homes, that various developers are planning on building, ranging from about $200,000 to $500,000. So by that measure, a $200,000 home is a starter home. Now, if you're buying that on the open market, you're going to have to put down 20% or $40,000, which is a big nut for most people to come up with. If you buy from a builder, depending on the kind of loan he can arrange and your credit, you might be able to get something for 5% down, which is still $10,000, which is a lot of money. And as I often say, buying a new house is really just the price of admission. There's always a lot more money to spend once you move in. Another thing to consider is that if you put down less than 20%, you need to buy something called mortgage insurance. And that's an extra cost. It basically is because you're putting so little down, it ensures the bank that they'll get at least that much back. You continue paying that mortgage insurance until you have paid off at least 20% of the loan. So there's that. So let's do a little math here. $200,000 starter home. Let's assume a best case scenario, $10,000, 5% down. That leaves a $190,000 mortgage. Let's say 3% currently for 30 years. I did a little checking. That's probably about right. There are points and things that you figured in. By my calculation, you're looking at about $800 a month plus taxes and insurance. For starters, Cypress area property tax rates are about 2.4%. That adds about $400 a month. Insurance might be about $1,800 a year, about $150 a month. So now that monthly mortgage payment, including your escrow for that $200,000 starter home, is going to be about $1,350 a month, optimistically. That's a 30-year loan. That will require a monthly household income of about $4,000 a month after taxes. So let's say a gross household income before taxes of about $60,000. Now, there are a lot of different ways to calculate this with many variables that can significantly affect these numbers. In my personal opinion, I think for the most part, they're fairly optimistic. So now let's discuss this in the context of the previous article on the need for hospitality workers. Let's say optimistically, you're a first-rate server at a great restaurant and they give you the best tables or at least lots of tables. And let's say you're making $20 an hour in wages and tips for 40 hours a week. That only comes to about $48,000 a year before taxes. So you're still only about halfway there after taxes. We're talking, what did you say, 18,220 rental units by the year 2030. So in the long run, somebody who can't afford a single family home will be able to afford a place to rent. Good luck with that. Listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 HD2 KPFT, Houston's community station. We now air live on Wednesdays at 11 a.m. on KPFT HD2. You can also hear the show live online at kpft.org, or you can podcast on your phone's podcast app, or you can go to archive.kpft.org, and you can see the last few weeks, about 6 or 8 weeks of shows there, as well as, of course, about 100 other show titles that are broadcast on KPFT. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, which is why you'll be able to find links to full articles on my blog at thinkwingradio.com. just click on Show Posts and More at the top of the page and find the post for the show or show date you're looking for, or you can type keywords into the search bar and perhaps turn up a story you're looking for that way. Check the show's Facebook page at Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig, and look for me on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. Our next story is entitled State Rep. Dan Huberty, Republican District 127, reflects on the 87th Legislative Session and Texas Public Education, also from CommunityImpact.com. At the Partnership Lake Houston State Luncheon on June 30th, State Rep. Huberty discussed the effects of virtual learning on standardized test scores as much of the state saw significant declines in 2021 math and English assessments. In late June, the state of Texas Assessments of Academic Readiness Benchmark, or STAR test, released its results. The percentage of students who passed exams was lower in almost every subject in spring 2021 compared to the last time the state administered STAR tests in spring of 2019, according to previous reporting by Community Impact newspaper. Huberty said, and that is what this online education did. Humble outperformed many of the districts in the Houston area because they had their kids back in the classroom. Of course, you know, no vaccinations and risking people getting sick and some of them dying, having long-term health effects, but, you know, neither here nor there. Huberty also sponsored House Bill 1525, which passed during the legislative session and allows the state to maintain teacher salaries and increase the state contribution for retired teachers and refunded dyslexia and autism grant programs. Huberty said the state needs to incentivize businesses to come to Texas and build out additional power generation units. Huberty hopes to address this in the special legislative session that begins July 8th. He goes on, we're burning about 79,000 megawatts. That's the capacity we have, and you're always going to have plants that go down. So when we think about the capacity issues that we had, we were down 20,000 megawatts when we were doing the rolling blackouts during Winter Storm Uri. That's a significant problem in businesses that rely on that manufacturing. Now, a couple of things stand out for me in that last couple of statements. First of all, he wants to incentivize companies to come down to Texas and increase generating capacity, which is okay. I don't necessarily have a problem with that. But of course, there are a couple of other things he could do. For example, he could introduce legislation to connect the Texas grid to the rest of the national grid, or the North American grid, for that matter. Push comes to shove, Texas could do some publicly owned utility generating plants. And I think, to me, one of the things that leaps out is, with the freeze we had, with people burning furniture to stay warm, with some folks actually dying from the cold, he said, that's a significant problem in businesses that rely on that manufacturing. So, of course, I'm only seeing the part that was quoted in the article, but I don't recall in the article anything about, and of course, the people freezing to death. It's just a mindset, you know? It's a mindset. Okay, from the Texas Tribune, Alan West announces he's going to run against Governor Greg Abbott in the Republican primary. Texas GOP chairman made his campaign official last Sunday on July 3rd. Since his election as Texas GOP chair in July of last year, when he soundly beat then-incumbent James Dickey, West has criticized Abbott's coronavirus response and sought to push the governor's legislative agenda further to the right. West is also a vocal Trump ally, though he has brushed off the impact of Trump's endorsement on his future political plans. West represented Florida in Congress, you may remember, from 2011 to 2013. He moved to Texas in 2014 to become the CEO of the National Center for Policy Analysis, a Dallas think tank that shuttered 3 years later. So, a great resume item there. 3 years and then out of business. You need to look up Alan West. He is really a crackpot, even among Republican crackpots. This is saying something. Also from the Texas Tribune, Texans with disabilities fear voting will get harder for them as special session on GOP restrictions nears. The extent to which Republicans' proposed voting restrictions might affect voters of color has received much attention, but Texans with disabilities also face the prospect of new barriers to the ballot law. It took Nancy Crowther 3 hours, 4 public bus rides, and an impressive amount of gumption to make sure her vote counted 2020 election. He's hoping Texas lawmakers don't make it even harder the next time. With Texas Republicans determined to enact additional voting restrictions in the upcoming special legislative session, much of the uproar has focused on changes that could make it harder for people of color to cast ballots. Less attention has fallen on another group of voters bracing for what could happen to them under the GOP's renewed push to further tighten the state's voting procedures, people with disabilities for whom the voting process is already lined with potential obstacles. Crowther, a 64-year-old retiree who could have been shut out from voting last November had it not been for her own tenacious determination, she's immunocompromised because of a neuromuscular disease and chose to forego her usual trip to a nearby polling place and instead turn to mail-in voting in hopes of safeguarding her health during the pandemic. But as Election Day neared, and after experiencing interruptions in her mail service, remember that wasn't accidental, she began to worry her ballot wouldn't make it to the county in time, and under Texas law she couldn't ask someone else to return her ballot, so Crowther, who uses the wheelchair, had to make the trip herself. When she finally got to where she thought she was supposed to be going, she queued up in a line of cars with her wheelchair for 20 minutes before a county worker asked if she was there to register a vehicle. She realized she was in the wrong line, and spotting the ballot envelope carefully tucked into the belt of her wheelchair, the worker pointed to some tents across the parking lot where ballot collection was taking place. Crowther said, "I dropped it in, and everybody cheered because they knew how much of a hassle it was, and I thought, okay, where's the bus I catch to go home?" In a state with some of the strictest voting rules in the country, Crowther's ordeal illustrates how easily access to the ballot can contract for marginalized voters when new challenges emerge, and the risk lawmakers run in setting up new restrictions, including changes some disabled voters might not be able to overcome. Of course, the risk lawmakers run depends on whether they consider it risky or, you know, basically part of the intent. Texas Republicans have pursued broad efforts this year to ratchet up voting restrictions in the aftermath of a high turnout election that saw high-profile fights over the state's voting rules, including the tight eligibility requirements for absentee voting. But as the GOP has worked to clamp down on what remains of a limited voting option, voters with disabilities, who are among the few groups of Texans eligible to vote by mail regardless of age, have been caught in the middle of the fight. Republicans have cast their proposals as election integrity measures to protect the voting process from fraud, even though there's no evidence it occurs on a widespread basis. And I've said this before, it's not so much that it's statistically negligible, it's also numerically negligible, like a totally different level of negligible. So, throughout the spring legislative session, nearly every version of the GOP's priority voting legislation raised alarms for disability rights advocates who warned lawmakers would likely run afoul of federal protections for disabled voters. This is actually a shortened version of a lengthy article that goes on to discuss a number of Republican proposals last session that would limit, inhibit, or intimidate disabled voters, among others. Everything is on the table. Democrats mull options for special session, including another walkout. After killing Republicans' priority voting bill during the regular legislative session, Democratic lawmakers are mulling how to try to stop it in the special session that is supposed to start July 8th. Outnumbered and virtually powerless to block conservative priorities they oppose, Democrats in the Texas legislature say they're keeping their options open as they prepare for a special session expected to revive the GOP elections bill. The line coming from Democrats across the spectrum, everything is on the table. That includes another walkout like the one that doomed Senate Bill 7 in the final hours of the regular legislative session when Democrats broke quorum. But this time, such a move could now imperil the pay of their staffers, since Governor Greg Abbott vetoed the funding, line item vetoes, we talked about that, Abbott vetoed the funding for the legislative branch, the whole branch, while telling lawmakers they could restore it in this special session that starts in less than a week. There are still a number of unknowns before Democrats can settle on a strategy, including what the full agenda will be for the special session, how Abbott will structure it, and what the elections bill will look like. Abbott announced on June 22nd that the special session will begin July 8th, but offered no other details, only saying the agenda would be announced before the session starts. I might observe that maybe the squishiness of the date and the squishiness of the agenda is because he figures one of the options on the table is the Democrats will lead the state, so there is no quorum. Just my cynical overview. Democrats will also have to consider Abbott's veto of funding for the legislature for the two-year budget cycle starting September 1st. That gives lawmakers an incentive to participate in the special session or potentially sacrifice their staffers' pay. There's going to be a lot of discussion in a lot of offices about that, whether basically like, hey, go for it or not. Abbott's veto was in retribution for the Democrats' walkout, but it affects more than 2,100 legislative staffers and individuals working at legislative agencies. Abbott has acknowledged that lawmakers' salaries are protected by the state constitution. Last week, Democrats and staffers sued over Abbott's veto, asking the state Supreme Court to reverse it. Abbott's office faces a Monday deadline, basically earlier this week, to respond to the lawsuit. Whatever Democrats decide to do, it could only cause another temporary delay in consideration of the election bill, given that they remain in the minority at the legislature, and only one Republican, Lyle Larson of San Antonio, has shown interest in splitting with his party. The special session also presents potentially tough choices for some Republicans, namely House Speaker David Thielen. After the walkout, he drew the wrath of Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who charged Thielen with mismanaging the House calendar and allowing Democrats the opportunity to break quorum. Thielen has denied that. At the same time, Thielen has said he will not resort to the most drastic of measures, locking the chamber doors and dispatching state police, if Democrats seek to abandon the chamber again. His office is nonetheless emphasizing its commitment to finishing the job on the voting legislation. Thielen spokesman Enrique Marquez says in a statement, "If it takes 100 special sessions, the Texas legislature will pass an election integrity bill that instills further confidence in the accuracy of our elections." Republicans are so great at messaging, even when their message is, you know, contrary to their messaging. One question for Democrats, the story goes on, is how much they should work with Republicans on the elections legislation, especially after they were largely cut out of negotiations over the final version of SB 7 at the end of the regular session. To be clear, House Democrats were not unanimous in their decision to break quorum over SB 7, and several appeared to stay behind, including a group of border area representatives. One of them, Representative Eddie Morales of Eagle Pass, said in a text message Tuesday that he supported and will continue to support fellow Democrats who walked out. But in his case, he felt it was best to remain on the floor with other Democrats from the border region and argue against the bill in person. Morales said as far as the special session goes, he needs to visit with the rest of his colleagues and leadership to see what strategies they plan on using. I will make an observation here that if these Democrats from the Valley could stay behind and still not have a quorum, in all likelihood, it was agreed that they would stay behind so they could observe the session in case there was anything they needed to transmit to their colleagues who had left the session and broken quorum. Again, just, you know, being a little cynical. Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT HD2 90.1 HD2, Houston's Community Station. We now air live Wednesdays at 11 a.m. You can also listen online at kpft.org, podcast it on your podcast app, or visit archive.kpft.org. KPFT is Houston's community station. That means we need community support to keep giving you our unique and varied programming. Over 100 individual programs. You can go to the new kpft.org and hit the donate button. Pick your favorite show, hopefully ours, and the amount of your donation, large, small, or in between, and you can get a lovely thank you gift. You can also donate by texting the word GIVE, G-I-V-E, to 713-526-5738. That's 713-526-5738. You can also spread the word. Word of mouth helps. And, you know, if you can't afford money right now, that helps, and we appreciate it. Okay, going on to the next story. You know, sometimes I am amazed at how much news I consume and how much stuff I only find out a couple of days, if then, after it happens. So this was kind of interesting. From businessinsider.com, you've probably heard about this, but I'm not just going to read the article. I have some analysis here. Hobby Lobby advocates for a Christian-run government, and Independence Day ads placed in many national newspapers. On Independence Day, Hobby Lobby ran an advertisement across the country that advocated for a Christian-run government. The ad, under the title One Nation Under God, included the biblical verse, "Blessed is the nation whose God is the Lord." The full-page ad featured three columns that quote former U.S. presidents and other historical figures, as well as Supreme Court rulings about Christianity. According to a quote from George Washington, "It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, to be grateful for His benefits, and humbly to implore His protection and favor." In a holiday message posted on its website, Hobby Lobby said they'd been placing holiday advertisements since founder David Green felt commissioned by God to make them after he saw advertisements during the 1995 Christmas. He said, "Before long, Hobby Lobby was placing beautiful full-page ads celebrating the real meaning of Christmas, Easter, and Independence Day in newspapers across the country. The impact and relevancy of these messages is ongoing." Some who saw the ad were upset at the call for combining church and state. So here's my analysis. So Hobby Lobby can now be considered, in my opinion, an out and proud, un-American, anti-constitutional, Christo-fascist advocacy organization. I guess if Andrew were here, he'd be proud. So it's good for you to know that when you shop. Maybe better to know when the FBI is investigating where corporate owners and Hobby Lobby's dark money is going. But now let's examine different aspects of the story as I see it. The Constitution of the United States, 1789, First Amendment, reads as follows. "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances." That third part is for another show, but the first two. Now, I'm no lawyer. In my humble lay opinion, the First Amendment wraps this up very nicely. So what does it mean in the context of the Hobby Lobby ad and their tweet? First, it means that Hobby Lobby or anyone else can place an ad in any venue willing to publish it, and they can pretty much say anything they want. In the absence of a publishing venue, which they are not guaranteed, they can stand on a street corner and say it, or they can somehow publish it themselves, as they have actually done. However, the so-called Establishment Clause of the First Amendment also literally prohibits a Christian U.S. government saying, this piece, "Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof." You can believe in God, you can have a religion, you can worship in your religion as you please, even if you're a president or an elected representative. You just can't govern based on it, basically. So this has been interpreted, this clause, as meaning that the establishment of a state-sponsored or endorsed religion is prohibited. It's the reason that state-sponsored prayer in school has been ruled unconstitutional. To understand the importance and intent of this part of the First Amendment, it's important to remember that when the Constitution was written, the Reformation's religious wars in Europe were recent history, occurring from the 16th century through the early 18th century, the early 1700s. It's remembering that this was from 1789. Many of the founders were born in the early to mid 1700s. So it's literally like today's adults having knowledge of World War II. It's recent historical memory. This is what was on the minds of the founders when they wrote the Establishment Clause. And I got this from Wikipedia just to sort of reinforce my recollection. The European Wars of Religion were a series of wars waged in Europe during the 16th, 17th, and early 18th centuries, fought after the Protestant Reformation began in 1517. The wars disrupted the religious and political order in the Catholic countries of Europe. So that's the explanation. The Constitution also states in the First Amendment, "Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press." And obviously, I'm pressing that. So the Constitution's First Amendment comes fully into play here, both in terms of Hobby Lobby's advocacy of a Christian U.S. and the constitutional prohibition against it. Hobby Lobby is advocating a type of civil U.S. government prohibited by the Constitution, but they have every right to advocate it, and you have every right to vehemently against it. Next story from BBC.com. European powers warn Iran over enriched uranium metal production. Tehran informed the International Atomic Energy Agency that the process was to develop fuel for a research reactor, which may be technically correct. But uranium metal could also be used to make the core of a nuclear bomb. European powers said Iran's move breached a nuclear deal and threatened talks to revive it. The U.S. called it an unfortunate step backwards. The 2015 deal, known formally as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA, saw Iran agree to restrictions to its nuclear program that were designed to minimize the risk of it developing a nuclear weapon. In return, six world powers, China, France, Germany, Russia, the United States, and the UK, agreed to lift economic sanctions that were in place. Former U.S. President Donald Trump pulled the U.S. out of the deal in 2018 and reinstated sanctions on Iran. Iran retaliated by gradually breaching its commitments under the accord. So, as in so many things, timing is everything. Trump broke the deal, and the JCPOA may be like Humpty Dumpty, nearly impossible to put back together again. Only history can judge. Well, and history can judge. From CNBC.com, this is interesting. I got some mileage out of this. U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan is more than 90% complete, the Pentagon says. Now, this you've probably heard, so this isn't going to be news. What's interesting, though, is considering the geopolitical implications for the six countries that border Afghanistan. There are Iran and Pakistan. Then there are the former Soviet republics of Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan. Plus, a little piece of Afghanistan that extends to the Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region of China. Afghanistan is also in close proximity to Russia and other countries, although not directly bordering. No matter how these countries feel about the United States, they all undoubtedly had mixed feelings about the U.S. being there. For some, the U.S. was a counterbalance to Russia and China. To others, it was an extension of U.S. imperialism at or near their doorsteps. China, Russia, and others, the U.S. also acted as a check on the Taliban. Now everything is changing. Russia is having to invest assets in aiding its former Soviet states in protecting their borders, although this may also serve Russia's interest in binding them closer to Russia. Nonetheless, Russia is not a rich country. It will be costly and require diverting Russian assets from their European ambitions. China's Xinjiang Uyghur Autonomous Region shares a small border with Afghanistan. Uyghurs are predominantly Muslim, and one of China's big concerns is the Taliban-style insurgency starting up there. The U.S. presence in Afghanistan actually served China's interests. While Turkmenistan, Uzbekistan, and Tajikistan are mostly Muslim countries, they have no desire to be destabilized by a Taliban-inspired insurgency, so they have also indirectly benefited from a U.S. presence. Biden's stated reason for leaving Afghanistan quickly is to end America's longest war, something with which I wholeheartedly agree. The U.S. didn't accomplish as much of what it hoped in the 20 years it's been there. Interestingly, in many complicated ways, it may geopolitically accomplish more by leaving, creating issues and complications and concerns and expenses for geopolitical adversaries like Russia and China. So it got me to wondering how much of this may have been part of Biden's decision-making process. Just a thought. Here's a story I've actually been holding for a while now. It's from January 28th, War on the Rocks. But I think in terms of geopolitical stuff, this might be a good place to talk about it. It's called The Arctic Threat That Must Not Be Named. Climate change is melting the ice in the Arctic. Climate change is opening up a new polar transit route. Climate change is unlocking access to oil, gas, and critical minerals under the ice. In fact, Mike Pompeo, you know, at the time, not only wouldn't say the words, he reportedly refused to sign a communique that the Arctic partners had worked out because it explicitly mentioned climate change. This is more than just eliding a term he found distasteful. Keep in mind, this article was from January of this year. Climate change is the variable that will drive all other calculations in the region, whether it's the icebreaker gap or China's pursuit of cryospheric real estate. Not taking climate fully into account risks higher opportunity costs at best and poor preparation for a challenging future at worst. And there is no time to waste with troubling signs that changes in the high north may actually be much worse than previously thought. The Defense Department's civilian leadership needs to take charge of the resourcing decisions and profusion of service-specific strategic vision. Otherwise, the Biden Pentagon may find it has backed spending money on the wrong things at a bad time. Going back to Afghanistan now. There are legitimate U.S. geostrategic and national interests that require attention in the Arctic. The new or expanding missions include search and rescue for increased tourist and commercial traffic in newly thawed seas, environmental cleanup, border safety, deterrence and defense, protection of important infrastructure such as undersea communications cables, and freedom of navigation through an increasingly open ocean. Moreover, Russia has taken an aggressive and occasionally provocative posture in the region, and China has declared itself a near Arctic nation, with its third heavy icebreaker under construction and land acquisition across the area. Since the end of the Cold War, the United States has become increasingly ill-equipped to defend U.S. interests in this area, but rectifying that mistake has to happen in the context of climate change. The Arctic is unusual in that climate change is agitating underlying frictions that are geopolitical in scope and involve some of the most advanced and well-armed societies in the world. While World War III is unlikely in the North Pole, there is a risk of miscalculation which could lead to escalation. Moreover, the friction in the North between the United States, Russia, and China is part of a larger pattern. What happens in the Arctic reflects what is happening in the South China Sea and Ukraine, and vice versa. Climate change has the potential to light a fuse in a formerly frozen place with impacts across the geopolitical landscape, or this formerly frozen place may be where a fuse lit elsewhere explodes. Admittedly, the latter is unlikely for now given the truly challenging operating conditions. When it comes to Russia, though, the Trump regime, did a lousy job of allocating resources to the risk. A good polar strategy should reflect the overall approach to the U.S. relationship with Russia. Deterrence in the North was never going to be especially productive when it was paired with Russian impunity everywhere else. NATO should be one of the most important U.S. investments in the region. Four of the five Arctic coastal states are NATO members, Russia being the fifth. Iceland, just a squidge off the literal, is a permanent member of the Arctic Council and also a NATO founding member. The United States has close bilateral and multilateral relationships with these nations and with the other Arctic Council member states, Sweden and Finland as well. These alliances and partnerships are an asset as tangible as any platform and far more powerful. All of these Arctic nations, including the United States, have pragmatic cooperative relationships with Russia and China as well, but the behavior of both countries in recent years has given most Arctic nations pause and a reason for increased cooperation with each other. The Trump people more or less squandered that opportunity with its negative messaging from the top, but the Biden administration gets the benefit of a fresh start. So countries have been looking for what they call a North Passage for over a century, close around two. But of course, it was icebound most or all of the year. Now, with global warming, something which I have a feeling some people in the Russian government think is advantageous to Russia because so much of Russia is so cold and, you know, global warming, it's starting to look like a place where you will get more naval activity, whether it's commerce, tourism, or military. It's not in this article, but I believe I have read that the United States currently only has one icebreaker, and they shuttle it between the North Pole, the Arctic, and the Antarctic. And it's a long trip, and it's an old ship. So it's something that we've really been ignoring. It's not so much, should we militarize the Arctic? That isn't necessarily the question here, because I don't think that's exactly what the opinion piece is saying. However, it is a place that could easily militarize. Russia does not have many open water ports. And now its northern ports are going to become a little more open to activity. So, you know, they can get out through the Arctic, they can get out through the Baltic Sea, or they can get out through Kamchatka in the North Pacific. That's pretty much their access to open water. And the Black Sea, where, of course, they have to go through the Dardanelles, which means passing through Turkey. And that's a whole other story with the Black Sea. So this is a non-trivial situation. Now, because I've been holding on to this story for a while, I do have a comment from Andrew that I am going to read. I'm going to read it in first person as Andrew. Andrew says, I have a radical idea. Why not have the U.S. and Canada cooperate with Russia and China for some of these geopolitical interests? Search and rescue, environmental protection and cleanup, and traffic management. Sure, border and infrastructure stuff is probably too top secret to collaborate on. I get that. And honestly, I'd prefer we stop climate change, this is Andrew speaking, that will create these new geopolitical interests in the first place. But if it's happening anyway, there's an opportunity here to repair the fraught relationship between Northwest and Northeast. It would probably have to be a gradual process. After all, the U.S.'s influence, expansionism, and warmongering traits will have cultivated plenty of mistrust. But if we're lucky, Andrew speaking, we might be able to turn the atomic scientist's doomsday clock back a minute or two. I'm all for anything averting Armageddon. So, Andrew and I have our differences of opinion. I think most of us are against climate change, which actually is global warming. Climate change is a Frank Luntz focus grouped term because it doesn't sound as scary as global warming. Warming scares people. Climate change, not so much. So I think Andrew and I agree on that. I think that it's not unfair to talk about the U.S. as being influentially expansionist. I mean, cultural imperialism is something the United States has been accused of, probably fairly. On the other hand, we're not holding a gun to people's heads in terms of cultural imperialism. You know, people make choices. I think that Andrew and I typically, even though our verbiage tends to be somewhat different, Andrew and I think, are not necessarily far apart on this. I think at the end of the day, the article says, yes, there should be cooperation with between the West and Russia and China when there can be, and there might not always be. But I think it's interesting that while we're having heat waves in many parts of North America, that we're now talking about Arctic ice. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 HKPFT, Houston's community station. We now air live 11 a.m. Wednesdays on HD2. You can listen at kpft.org live or your podcast app or archive.kpft.org. Every story on the show is heavily excerpted, so you can find the full stories, links to the full stories, on my website at thinkwingradio.com. Click on the show posts and more at the top of the page. Find the post with the show or show date. You can type in keywords in the search bar. You can also follow me on Facebook at Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig and on Twitter at Think Wing Radio. I have a couple of other backlogged stories that I've been saving that are climate related. This one is actually from September of 2020 from phys.org. That's phys.org. Marine heat waves are human made. Waves in the world's oceans have become over 20 times more frequent due to human influence. This is what researchers from the Ørsted Center for Climate Research at the University of Bern are now able to prove. Marine heat waves destroy ecosystems and damage fisheries. A marine heat wave, or ocean heat wave, is an extended period of time in which the water temperature in a particular ocean region is abnormally high. In recent years, heat waves of this kind have caused considerable changes to the ecosystems in the open sea and at the coast. Their list of negative effects is long. Marine heat waves can lead to increased mortality among birds, fish, and marine mammals. They can trigger harmful algal blooms and greatly reduce the supply of nutrients in the ocean. Heat waves also lead to coral bleaching, trigger movements of fish communities to colder waters, and may contribute to the sharp decline of the polar ice caps. In what was then a recently published paper in Science, the authors concluded that the probability of such events has increased massively as a result of global warming. The analysis has shown that in the past 40 years, marine heat waves have become considerably longer and more pronounced in all of the world's oceans. Explained Charlotte Lufkauter, the recent heat waves have had a serious impact on marine ecosystems, which need a long time to recover afterwards, if they ever fully recover. According to the findings of the attribution studies, major marine heat waves have become more than 20 times more frequent due to human influence. While they occurred every 100 or 1,000 years in the pre-industrial age, depending on the progress of global warming, in the future they are set to become the norm. If we are able to limit global warming to about 1.5 degrees centigrade, heat waves will occur once every decade or century. If temperatures rise by 3 degrees centigrade, however, extreme situations can be expected to occur in the world's oceans more than once per year or decade. And from the BBC.com, this goes all the way back to July of 2020. Again, I've been saving it. How humans are altering the tides of the oceans. In the mid-2000s, Stefan Talke was a postdoctoral scholar at Utrecht University studying the River Ems that empties into the North Sea between Germany and the Netherlands. Decades earlier, engineers had begun dredging parts of the Ems so that newly built ships could navigate it from a shipyard upriver. But those changes also changed the rhythm with which tides ebbed and flowed into the river from the sea. Those shifting tides stirred up sediment from the river bottom and muddied its waters. Over the last 120 years, the tidal range, which is to say the distance between high and low tide, has quintupled in the Dems estuary. Most people think of tides as regular and predictable, the rise and fall of coastal waters caused by the gravitational tug of the moon and the sun, forecast down to the minute with a mariner's tide table. But oceanographers have recently started to realize that tides in many places around the world are undergoing notable changes in ways that can't be explained by interactions among celestial bodies. Rather, it is people that are changing the tides. Dredging river channels like the Ems or filling in coastal wetlands can trigger shifts. The nature of those shifts is complicated. In some locations, the tidal range grows more dramatic, whereas in others, it shrinks. Either way, the shifting tides have big implications for hundreds of millions of coastal residents. Perhaps the biggest challenge is how changing tides might add to the risks of sea level rise. Engineers have known for at least a century that tides can change locally, but only recently have scientists collected modern, precise tide gauge data from around the world showing just how widespread tidal changes have become. Says Ivan Haig, an oceanographer at the University of Southampton in the UK, it wasn't really until about 10 years ago that we started to appreciate that it's occurring on a much wider level. In that sense, it's not terribly surprising that tides have changed dramatically in places where people have changed the shape of the underwater landscape. In the Thames estuary that runs through London, engineers have narrowed and deepened the river over centuries. Its tidal range has increased from around 2 meters in the time of the Romans to around 8 meters, that's 26 feet, in the Victorian Age. Water depth is another important factor in tidal changes. Because tides propagate as shallow water waves, they change the most wherever the water is also shallow. That's why the Bay of Fundy, between New Brunswick and Nova Scotia in Canada, has some of the most dramatic tidal ranges in the world, where waters rising and falling more than 11 meters or 36 feet each day. Shallow spots like this are likely to see large changes in tidal range as sea levels rise, Haig says. For our last story from the Think Wing treasure chest, from the New York Times, September 2020, is there a black hole in our backyard? astrophysicists have recently begun hatching plans to find out just how weird Planet Nine might be. Although it is probably wishful thinking, some astronomers contend that a black hole may be lurking in the outer reaches of our solar system. All summer they've been arguing over how to find it. This was, of course, last summer. And if indeed it is there, and what to do about it, proposing plans that are only halfway out of this world. The speculation began in 2016 with calculations that object would be roughly 10 times as massive as Earth and occupy an egg-shaped orbit that brought it as near as 20 billion miles from the Sun, several times the distance from Pluto to the Sun, and took it as far as 100 billion miles away in an orbit that could be 10 to 20,000 years long. Nobody has seen this through a telescope. Last year, another pair of astronomers suggested Planet Nine might actually be a black hole, but not just any kind of black hole. In 1971, Stephen Hawking, drawing on an idea earlier suggested in 1966 by two Russian physicists, theorized that intense pressures during the Big Bang could have collapsed matter directly into black holes. Those primordial black holes could be of any size and could be anywhere. A black hole as massive as Earth would be about the size of a ping pong ball and would be exceptionally hard to see. That would make Planet Nine the nearest black hole to Earth by many light years, so close that humans could contemplate sending a robot probe there, much as New Horizons past Pluto and the dumbbell iceberg now known as Arrokoth, or previously known as Arrokoth, 4 billion miles from here. But first we must find Planet Nine. In July of last year, Dr. Avi Loeb, chair of the astronomy department at Harvard with a student Amir Sarai, had a new idea for finding the Planet Nine black hole. If it were out there, they argued, it would occasionally rip apart small comets, causing bright flares that could soon be spotted by the new Vera C. Rubin Observatory, previously known as the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, now under construction in Chile. Such flares should occur a few times a year, they noted. Moreover, because the Rubin telescope examines such a large swath of sky, it could detect or rule out black holes of similar size all the way out to the Oort cloud, a vague and diffuse assemblage of proto-comets and primordial frozen riffraff a billion miles from the sun. If the theory pans out, it's not crazy to think that humans could contemplate sending a probe to study our local black hole. What would it learn? You've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on 90.1 KPFT, HD2, Houston's community station. My co-host, unfortunately not here today, got the day off, is Andrew Ferguson. We appreciate your listening. Look forward to speaking with you next week. Take care. Oh, can't you see the morning after? It's waiting right outside the store. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving. Greetings, KPFT listeners. This is DJ Metalord, host of Sweet Nightmares Radio Show. Sweet Nightmares Radio Show has been supporting the Metal Underground and everything in between, from the classics to the newest releases, since 1987. You can catch the show every Thursday, 11 p.m. to 2 a.m. on the FM band. Also, listen to an encore presentation every Saturday. Yes, every Saturday, 6 p.m. to 9 p.m. on the HD2 channel. Sweet Nightmares, only on 90.1 KPFT, Houston.
Hi, I'm Charles Hightower, host of the R&B Gold Show, 6 p.m. till 8, right here on KPFT, Houston's community station. I'll be moving and grooving with all the good classic soul just for you on KPFT, FM, and FM HD1 Houston.
And the forecast for KPFT calls for an 80% chance of showers and thunderstorms, high near 82. For tonight, showers and thunderstorms possible, 80% chance, low near 74. And then Thursday, showers and thunderstorms remaining at an 80% chance with a high near 86. Thursday night drops to a 30% chance of rain, mostly cloudy, 76. That's the forecast for KPFT.
KPFT.
KPFT-FM HD2, Houston. KPFT.
And y'all are tuned in to K-Reno Radio right here on KPFT.